City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Leonard?
Here.
Saltzman? Sten? Potter?
Here. I'd like to remind folks, prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Agenda item 1286, appeal of Eric Reistad, applicant, against the hearing officer's decision to deny a 73-unit planned development with modifications to landscaping, setbacks, height, and loading spaces at 4027 Southeast 174th Avenue, LU06, 185-546, PDM.
The city attorney will describe the hearing process.
Hey, this is an on-the-record hearing. This means you must limit your testimony to material and issues in the record. This hearing is designed only to decide if the hearings officer made the correct decision based on the evidence that was presented to him. If you start to talk about new issues or try to present new evidence today, you may be interrupted and reminded that you must limit your testimony to the record. We will begin with a staff report by the Bureau of Development Services staff for approximately 10 minutes. Following the staff report, the City Council will hear from interested persons in the following order. The appellant will go first and will have 10 minutes to present his or her case. Following the appellant, persons who support the appeal will go next. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak to the council. The principal opponent will have 15 minutes to address the City Council and rebut the appellant's presentation. After the principal opponent, the council will hear from persons who oppose the appeal. Again, each person will have 3 minutes. Finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes to rebut the presentation of the opponents of the appeal. The council may then close the hearing, deliberate, and take a vote on the appeal. If the vote is a tentative vote, the council will set a future date for the adoption of findings and a final vote on the appeal. If the council takes a final vote today, that will conclude the matter before the council. I would like to announce several guidelines for those who will be addressing City Council today. Again, this is an on-the-record hearing. This means you must limit your remarks to arguments based on the record compiled by the hearings officer. You may refer to evidence that was previously submitted to the hearings officer. You may not submit new evidence today that was not submitted to the hearings officer. If your argument includes new evidence or issues, the council will not consider it and it will be rejected in the City Council's final decision. If you believe a person who addressed City Council today improperly presented new evidence or presented a legal argument that relies on evidence that is not in the record, you may object to that argument. Finally, under state law, only issues that were raised before the hearings officer may be raised in this appeal to City Council. If you believe another person has raised issues today that were not raised before the hearings officer, you may object to Council's consideration of that issue.
Do any members of council wish to declare a conflict of interest? No council members have a conflict of interest to declare. Do any members of council have any ex parte contacts to declare or information gathered outside of hearings to disclose? No council members have ex parte contacts to declare. Do any member of council have questions or other preliminary matters that need to be addressed before we begin the hearing? We're going to begin the hearing with a staff report from the Bureau of Development Services.
Good afternoon. I'm Kimberly Parsons with Bureau of Development Services, and this is the presentation for Appeal of Land Use Review 06-185546, PDM. The purpose of the hearing today is to consider an appeal of the hearings officer decision to deny a plan development review for a 73-unit, 4- and 5-story mixed-use building and modifications to development standards. The applicant requested a plan development review for a 73-unit residential and commercial building. The review was triggered because the applicant is transferring residential density from the CG zoned portion of the property to the R3 zoned portion of the site. Several modifications to development standards were requested. With the exception of the height modifications, the criteria were found to be met. So the focus of today's hearing is the modification to increase the height in the R3 zone by 10 feet and to increase the height in the CG zone by 11.5 feet. These are the citations for the relevant approval criteria for the plan development review and the modifications to development standards. The hearings officer denied the proposal due to the following criteria not being met. 33-65-310 A and B to visually integrate the development into the surrounding area. 33-665-320 B, modification to increase the height in the R3 zone and the CG zone. And 33-665-340 B, tree preservation. The decision also listed a development standard that was not met for parking. The site is located at the corner of Southeast Powell and Southeast 174th. The site is zoned R3, which is multi-dwelling residential, on the northern third, and CG, general commercial, on the remaining portion. The R3 zone is characterized as generally one- and two-story buildings with a relatively low building coverage. The major type of development in this zone is townhouses and small multi-dwelling residences. The CG zone is characterized as generally auto-accommodating commercial development. The site is also located within the Johnson Creek Basin Plan District, South Subdistrict, which limits impervious surface area to a maximum of 50% of the site. And the project met this standard with the use of pervious pavers for the parking areas. The surrounding area is best characterized as transitioning from low-density multi-dwelling development to more intense multi-family and commercial uses. And the site here is outlined in red. South of the site is generally underdeveloped, with one-story commercial buildings set away from the street and surrounded by parking. To the east and west of the site are two-story apartment buildings scattered around the properties with open lawn areas and separate parking areas. And then to the north of the site is generally one- and two-story single-family homes. This plan shows the location of the building on the site pushed toward the corner of the property with parking areas and landscaping. This plan also reflects the approximately 8,900 square feet of street dedication that's being required by Oregon Department of Transportation, as well as Portland Office of Transportation. So the ODOT dedication requirements on Southeast Powell are approximately 23 feet, and the PDOT requirements for dedication on Southeast 174th range from 10 to 25 feet. This elevation of the building shows the five stories proposed in the CG zone at the corner of the site, and then dropping down to the four stories within the R3 zone. And then these are other views of the proposed project showing the five and four-story elevations of the building along 174th. And then this shows the view of the building from Southeast Powell. This is the site facing southwest, so there are a couple buildings currently located there. And then this is facing north from the site, so you can see the single-family development in the background. And then this is facing Southeast Powell, facing east at the Powell and 174th intersection, so you can see some of the commercial development that exists. And then this is the typical multi-dwelling development. This is a representative of the one- and two-story development in the area, and these existing buildings are located across the street from the site and adjacent to the site. And then this is representative of the low-intensity one-story commercial development in the area. The appellant listed the following points in their appeal statement. The appellant stated that the additional planting was proposed to mitigate for preserving 31% instead of 35% of the total tree diameter on the site. And the proposal meets the criteria. So if the project is approved by council, this will need to be clarified in the decision. The second issue is that there's a statement in the conclusion of the hearings officer decision that the applicant hasn't met parking requirements. But with conditions of approval, they can be met. So this would also need to be clarified in the decision if approved. The main focus of the appeal is the height modification, and the appellant states that the proposed project will visually integrate with the surrounding area and therefore should be approved. For the modification, the criteria require that the proposal must better visually integrate the development into the surrounding area. The hearings officer found that even under the current height standards of 35 feet in the R3 zone and 45 feet in the CG zone, the proposed building would be considerably taller than any building in the surrounding area. And as I pointed out previously in the slides, those are generally 1 to 2 stories tall. The hearings officer then went on to say that the proposed development would be only comparable in height to future development that could be built on the surrounding properties. The hearings officer found that further increasing the height does not promote a reasonable building scale and relationship of one residence to another. Increasing the building height by 10 feet in the R3 zone and 11.5 feet in the CG zone is not consistent with the purpose of the height standards of the base zones. The hearings officer found that the applicant has failed to show how a taller building than the existing maximum height better visually integrates the project into the surrounding area and that this criterion was not met. So in summary, the applicant's tree preservation plan does meet the criteria, so the findings should be clarified if approved. The parking requirements can be met with conditions, so the conclusion statement should be clarified if approved. However, the hearings officer found that increasing the height does not promote a reasonable building scale and relationship of one residence to another. And the hearings officer found that the applicant has failed to show how a taller building than the existing maximum height better visually integrates the project into the surrounding area. The alternatives before council today are to deny the appeal, which would uphold the hearings officer decision for denial of the proposal, or to uphold the appeal, thereby overturning the hearings officer decision and adopt revised findings and conditions of approval. So that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Could the appellant please come forward? When you speak, please state your name for the record, and you have up to 10 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Dane. I'm principal of Blue Sky Planning. Beside me is Ralph Turin, the principal architect. We're here today representing Eric Reistad. We're here before you because we believe that the hearings officer erred on all three of his opinions. To give you a brief history, we started the project in June of 06 with a three-story project with about a 100-unit apartment condominium. Given the fact that we found that we were in the Johnson Creek sub-area, where 50% of the property was automatically removed for impervious area, we then also discovered that a substantial portion of our property would be taken for the ODOT highway and for 174th. Essentially, we were left with one-third of the area we started with to build. We could build on one-third of the gross site area. We then worked with staff, submitted in January, got a completion in May, and hoped to be on hearing in June. Unfortunately, staff was not able to receive the responses they needed, so the hearing went on to July. Unfortunately, staff wasn't able to receive the responses they needed again, so we pushed back to August. At the day of the hearing, there were still responses that hadn't occurred. We got one response from ODOT. Essentially, what I'm trying to say here is material was moving in right to the last day, and the hearings officer was put in a very difficult position. He was also put in a difficult position because the issue at stake, putting aside the parking and the trees, which were mistakes without question, was that he was being asked to judge a height modification and asked to judge essentially an architectural standard. Being a land use attorney, he was put in a very difficult situation. As we move forward, the request is for the modification of height. The project is by a local builder who is trying to construct affordable housing, hopefully selling at $140,000 apiece. This area is not downtown, it's not hip and trendy, it's not an urban renewal district. This is Powell 174th. This is an area that has not been invested in. But this is the southeast gateway to your city. This is the entrance on a state highway with a right-of-way 105 foot wide and 174th. This is a massive intersection. This property right now is a vacant lot. It is surrounded by some interesting projects. This is what the property is right now, vacant wire. Essentially, it's used for Christmas trees. Across the road, pumps, not even a gas station, essentially a series of pumps. Behind it, some old apartments, T111 siding, 312 pitch. Been around for a long time. Across the road, a massive sea of asphalt with some tilt-ups and some blue awnings. One thing we are seeing here constantly is plastic blue awnings, which do seem to have precedence in this area. A few other things. On 124th, 500 feet south on 124th, there are some existing houses directly to the north of the property. Is this house. But this is actually being torn down for some townhomes. What we have and what we're proposing is a property that will step down from the corner from five stories at the intersection to four stories on the north end with 50 foot of spacing to the adjacent property, which is being rezoned to R2, which will allow a three-story townhome, which, interestingly enough, with a peak roof, could go up to 47 feet and have its roof higher than the roof that we're proposing, the flat roof that we're proposing. And then after that, R7 to the north, essentially two-story houses. So it's saying
sorry,
five...
Was that last statement again? What was going to have the peak roof?
What I was saying was that we are required to do flat roof. We're doing flat roof to work with the commercial area. The property to the north is going to be rezoned R2.
Okay. Gotcha.
And we have proposed to do the flat roof zoning, but the property to the north is being developed with a townhouse, which, with the three-story, it's allowed to go at the R2 to 40 feet in height, do a 12-12 pitch, say, I don't know, on a 30-foot wide house, gives you a 15-foot height, 7.5 foot is where you measure it, so you're 47.5 feet.
Okay.
So we're saying the development to the north would actually be, theoretically, 2.5 feet higher than our development.
Thank you.
So 5-4-3, and then beyond that, the R7, the two-story. We are stating here that we are transitioning with bricks, not T111, with cast slabs, not tilt-ups, with color, not beige, with walls, not chain-link fence, with contrast and not repetition. We believe that, as the hearings officer did state, this building does not meet the asphalt. It does not have blue banners. It is not tilt up. This is a quality product, and it matches the intended zoning, the intended uses, the intended height. We are trying to see where this area will go in the future. We designed this project for the future, not for the past.
Thank you. I'm Ralph Tarrant, architect, and I'm going to talk as fast as I can to try to meet the time limit. As Mark mentioned, we start out with a three-story project as we would in a suburban location like this. However, with a 50% coverage requirement in Johnson Creek overlay, plus we got 16% of our property taken away by ODOT. And this is not just a dedication. We're required to build this intersection. We have no public financing. We have no public subsidies, nor are we asking for it. What we are doing is shifting from three-story development and saying, okay, it's also a transit street. When you saw the aerial photos, did you think that was transit development? It's not. We do not integrate with that surrounding development, nor could we get a project approved in the city of Portland if we did visually integrate with what is currently there. This is a hope for the future. This is an extremely bold move on the developer's part to say, okay, with all those constraints, what do you guys do? Well, we've had to push the envelope in every place that we possibly can. Our maximum density required is 105 units. We started with 100, as Mark said, but as our site became whittled and whittled and whittled, and doing a lot of things that I do on very urban projects, such as pervious pavers to meet our stormwater requirements, we've invented a new stormwater standard for ODOT, an ODOT / City of Portland standard along the way. And by the way, we had to design a building. So what we did was fall back on what are the accepted urban design standards in the City of Portland. We are the gateway to the City of Portland from the east side. We fell back on saying we need to build up the corner, build a strong corner, and bring our project up to the street and present a building that is one that will provide hope for other buildings in this area. I think that this project will provide a strong vote of confidence for redevelopment in this area and show that we need to finally start doing something to develop a transit street. We've spent thousands and thousands of dollars and time, staff time, and various agency time to try to figure out what do we do on this edge. And what we have ended up with in our proposal is a project where we had to stretch the height to be able to get reasonable living units. And we're at 73 living units right now with this minor height adjustment that we're asking for. We're asking up at the corner, we have very generous setbacks for a project of this kind of density. We're 50 feet away from the property line to the north side. We're 14 feet away from the two-story 70s apartment building to the west of us. We feel that we've been very responsible in our design, and we have taken and applied all kinds of urban design aspects that I normally would apply in a luxury-type development. We're doing it in a modest setting, providing very dignified housing at an entry-level cost. We've got all of the tried and true traditions of the city of Portland, a tripartite building with brick base, a body, a strong cornice line, and a cap. It's all of the things that we try to do as we're building our community. We've set the building back 5 feet up on the top. Actually, when we went into the hearings officer meeting, we actually had approval or a recommendation of approval from the city staff of our height. The height hasn't been an issue. The height has been accepted as something that is a reasonable thing to accept in this corner. It's a very harsh corner. It has nothing around it. There is nothing to relate to. What was in argument is, can we come out in certain areas, have an undulating top level? We never got a chance to discuss that. We never got a chance to talk design. I have a strong feeling if I would have been able to go to the design commission, as I normally do on something like this, that a design advisory request would have encouraged this approach and probably applauded this approach in terms of it being a very creative, innovative way of providing up to the maximum density we can possibly have. I really encourage you to support our request. This is the final piece of this project to do something good on this corner. There are so many positive attributes to this project that it would be a shame for it to go away and have it start over. I sincerely ask your support for this project, and I would be happy to answer any questions in whatever detail you would like to ask. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Are there any questions, gentlemen?
Yes. I want to start off by saying that I think I'm probably more familiar with this intersection than my colleagues. I live out this way, drive this way often, and will say that if anything, you've underestimated the importance of a project such as you're proposing for the conditions that currently exist. You haven't pointed out, and I will, that right across the street there was an Albertsons store that was closed a long time ago that now sits boarded up, defaced, and what the prospects are for that, I do not know. I'm sure I'm going to get some cards and letters for the following comment, but I have to say that from the Ross Island Bridge out to this point, I don't know of another development that in fact has been completed or is proposed that is more attractive than what you are proposing. I think that anyone who were actually to stand and look at the conditions under which this will be placed would have to concede that it is a huge benefit to the community. But having said that, I recognize that there are some issues that we need to resolve. And so for me, one of the important points is something you alluded to, and that is the cost of the housing.
Yes.
Can you describe again what the price range is for the housing that you intend to build here and how many units there will be?
Yeah, essentially, we're trying to create housing that is suitable for this neighborhood, that is appropriate for this neighborhood, entry-level housing, and Ralph will speak to that in a second. But we're not just doing the housing, we're doing the housing with the amenities, including the child's play area. We basically try to create entry-level housing for basically maybe single mothers with young children, secured parking for them, and try to incorporate a lot of the Centennial neighborhood's own livability index that they had. We hit all those notes. We didn't have to, but we did. And part of that livability is to do with the height and the size and the space and the light of those. So to answer that.
We realize that we are in a modest area. And however, that doesn't mean that we can't design something nice. The mix of units that we're providing as our footprint continued to shrink, the mix of units changed from approximately 3/4 two-bedroom, two-bath units and 25% one-bedrooms to closer to almost a 50-50 mix of one-bedroom and two-bedroom apartments. And so...
So I'm sorry, they're apartments and not condominiums?
There are condominiums.
Okay. So my
ownership.
My question is, what is the price range?
Okay. At this point, what we're talking about is $140,000 on up to, I would guess the range on the upper end is going to be 200 to 220 is the numbers that we've talked about.
All within an affordable range for
very
well,
nice
we
setting.
Feel that is within what would typically be called in terms of HUD requirements or something, 80% of the mean income area.
And do you have any tax abatements or other kinds of financial assistance from any governmental entity to fund this project?
No, we don't. It's entirely privately financed.
If you wish to volunteer some, though.
I mean, we'd love to find this be an enhancement area
We have found we have significant offsite improvements. We are increasing the width of the highway out there, and we have a quite a heavy offsite burden. We're here because we want this to work. We want to find a way to make this project work. It's essential for the builder for this to work. I think it's a good thing for the city. We want to find a resolution here today. We know we can't make everybody absolutely happy, but this is a good project. This provides jobs. This provides affordable housing. This could act as a catalyst for this community in this area. And because of the constraints, no other project has been able to work or develop because of the overlay, because of the 50% restriction. This is a difficult area to work in.
We think it's a very good example as to how do you develop in Johnson Creek overlay.
Yeah.
And there aren't too many more sites like this. So in terms of us setting a precedent for all five-story buildings, I don't think so. And we want to build a strong corner. And so the fact that we are on the corner, I think, helps our case in terms of it being a little taller, and then it steps... If people did four-story or five-story next to us, we'd be really happy.
Thank you.
We're pioneering.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, gentlemen?
No.
Thank you.
Are there persons who support the appeal?
We have one more person signed up. Thomas Cutler. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Then persons who oppose the appeal.
No one signed up, but is are there any opposers to the appeal who wish to speak? You can come forward. You can come forward.
I think he was waving at somebody else.
Oh, okay.
Carla, he wasn't. Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to make a motion?
Yeah. Do we need to have a? I don't guess we don't need a rebuttal.
No, but it is. Not time for council deliberation.
I would move to uphold the appeal and adopt the proposed findings and conclusions. Is that the way you stated it? I'm sorry.
Conditions.
I'm sorry. Adopt the proposed findings and conditions of what again?
Conditions of approval.
Conditions of approval.
Deny the appeal or uphold?
Uphold the appeal and adopt the proposed finding and conclusions, which would allow the project to move forward with the conditions that staff had suggested.
And if I would second that motion.
What are the suggestions from the staff?
The conditions, if you're upholding the appeal, the conditions of approval that would need to be adopted are outlined in the staff report and recommendation.
And what are those? Can you just give us high points without getting too detailed?
Sure.
Tree replanting is one of them.
Street dedication requirements, right-of-way improvements, decommissioning existing septic systems, finalizing demo permits, tree preservation, and then conditions on parking based on the type of use that'll be in the tenant space.
Thank you.
Ready to call a vote?
Adams?
I think this is a fantastic design and a gutsy investment that I fully applaud. Thank you. Aye.
Leonard?
And I want to repeat what I said earlier. This is really an important project that I, too, appreciate very much. In fact, I am so intrigued by it. Had you come to me and asked for some assistance, I would have tried to see what I could do to make it happen, because this is a part of the city that desperately needs this kind of development. I would remind those listening that this is the part of the city that now is experiencing the same kind of crime and the same kind of issues that the Inner East Side experienced in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And this is exactly the part of Portland that a lot of that has moved to. So investing in owner-occupied residences that will allow first-time home buyers to live there and on a bus line. And hopefully this would do something to interest another supermarket to open across the street, would really do wonders in changing the conditions around in this area. So I appreciate the effort that's gone into this and the investment and the risk involved, and I'm happy to support it. Aye.
Stan.
I agree. Aye.
Potter.
Aye. When will the findings come back for a vote?
14th, okay. Those will be heard on November 14th in the morning session.
Okay. The motion to deny the appeal passed. The appeal is tentatively denied. Excuse me.
The motion to uphold the appeal.
Yes. Yeah, the motion to grant the appeal passed. The appeal is tentatively granted, and the hearings officer decision is overturned. The matter will return to council on that date mentioned for the adoption of findings and a final vote. Thank you very much, folks.
Thank you very much.
We still have 5 minutes before the 2:45 time certain. Why don't we proceed with 1288?
Sorry, which one did you want to go to, Mayor?
1288.
That's part of the 2:45 p.m.
Okay.
And 1289 also. Did you want to do the PGE one, Commissioner, or hold off on that?
We could. I don't think there'll be a ton of testimony on that. It might delay us a little bit, but. Why not?
Okay. Please read item 1274.
Authorized city attorney to settle litigation brought by Portland General Electric.
Commissioner Stinn.
Well, thanks, Mayor Potter. This was, sorry for scheduling this yesterday. It was meant to be today. This is a proposed settlement to our lawsuit with Portland General Electric, which I'm actually glad to have in front of us. I thought we would have been here faster. Actually, I thought that PG would have complied with the subpoena that we sent to them, but that did not happen. About 2 years ago, the council began an investigation into what actually happened with the taxes that Enron collected through PGE from PGE ratepayers and did not pay to the state. And This is a longer story, I think, and people have a lot of detail, but obviously the state has since passed a law trying to fix that problem, and we have continued to want to see the documents, and our argument has never been that the city could fix all these things, but we thought that the city, through using its powers that we have over utilities, would have a chance to look at the tax documents to understand what happened and hopefully, I think, propose some fixes in the future that may make sure that a situation like this doesn't happen again. And I think everybody's point of view is relatively straightforward. If you collect local taxes, state taxes, or federal taxes from the ratepayers, they ought to be paid to the government or refunded to the taxpayers. And that's what we're after. Obviously, the documents were not provided via the subpoena, and we've spent, well, it blends a little bit, the last 6 or 8 months in a mediation trying to come to a solution. And I'm actually quite happy to say that after we pass this today, I believe Portland General Electric will support this settlement and we'll be able to move forward. And essentially, it's a two-part settlement. There's two types of documents. The first are all of the documents that Portland General Electric provided to FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And while many of those are public records, they are very hard to find and almost impossible to get to. And these are, in broad terms, all the documents that have to do with what happened with the trading between Enron and PGE during the California energy crisis. And those documents will all be provided to us on a user-friendly form, and my expectation will be that we will probably post them to a city website and allow the public to take a look at them. And I think that is sort of a basic service that I'd like to provide. And for those people who are still remember what happened with the California energy crisis, this will be a chance for the public to take a look and to get at the bottom of things. The second is the more controversial piece, which is the actual tax documents from the years in question. And PGE has remained reluctant to provide those. Reluctant isn't right. Unwilling to provide those. While I still believe that our subpoena power allows us to look at those tax documents, I certainly understand why they don't want to provide them to us, and I don't see this getting resolved anytime soon. I think it'll go to many, many levels of court. So we did what I think is the right thing to do and tried to find a middle ground. And so what this settlement proposes, if the council is amenable, is that PGE will provide all of the tax documents in essentially a safe place to be reviewed by a consultant that we will choose. It gets a little bit it's this classic settlement off of a list that we both agree to, but at our choice, and there'll be three or four consultants that are all qualified that we would be able to use. That consultant, at our cost and with our sole discretion, would review all of the tax documents and essentially prepare a report for the public to read. So we would actually never take the documents into the city's possession, and we would not be able to provide them publicly, but we will have full access to them through an agent of ours, and we'll be able to share what we found. And so why I think this is a reasonable settlement is I'm not personally, and I don't think the council is, after holding and controlling PGE's tax documents. What we want to know is what they did. And the full report of the consultant with the details of what happened and recommendations for what to go forward would become a public document. We will have sole discretion as to what is in that report, and PGE will have a chance to review the report, but not a chance to edit it in any way, shape, or form. There's also a clause. When I first started thinking about this, I thought, well, but, you know, what if, since we don't know all the documents, what if we didn't ask for all the right documents? And we've thought about that, and PGE has agreed to it, and it basically says, if the consultant finds that there are documents that weren't covered in the original list that need to be looked at as part of the logical extension of what we're looking at, those would be provided as well. So, you know, in the range of settlements, when you settle a lawsuit, neither side gets everything that they wanted. I would certainly prefer to have those documents. I actually could go on and on why I think that it doesn't make sense that a publicly regulated company should be able to keep its documents this confidential, but that's a whole other debate. I do think it's my estimation that, well, I believe, I'm not a lawyer, but I've spent a lot of time with utilities lawyers on this very case. I do believe our subpoena will eventually hold up. I think it could be many, many years because I think it'll be litigated until it goes through the Supreme Court. And at this point, I think memories are already getting foggy. And if we can get to the bottom line of what actually happened, again, I don't think we are of any mindset that the city is going to be able to get any money back for ratepayers. The whole point is to try and figure out what were the the omissions in public policy that allowed this tax ripoff to happen, and then to go back and try and advocate both at a city and state and federal level that we close those doors. And I think we will be able to get the information we need to do that. So we will get the FERC documents. We will be able to put those in a public forum, which I think is a huge service to people. You may recall some of the people working for us believe there are things that the public should see in those documents but could not get them out of the FERC proceeding. And then the tax documents we will not be able to look at, but we will have experts who work for us, an expert who works for us, look at those and get the information out to the public. So given the cost, the uncertainty of litigating this for several more years, and given that I think this meets the bulk of our policy objectives, I would recommend this settlement to the council. And if our attorney Tracy would like to say anything, or Ben, did you want to? Ben Walters and Tracy Reeves have slogged through a very difficult case and done a very able and masterful job representing us, and I just want to thank both of them for their work, and I think this is a good settlement. And Ben, tell them what I got wrong.
That was a good summary. Ben Walters with the City Attorney's Office. The next steps from here are that the mediator will be providing names to the City Attorney's Office of consultant candidates. We'll be working with the commissioner's offices in terms of identifying a scope of work so that we can contact the consultants and identify for them what the council's general expectations are. And then we'll work up a proposal that will then be submitted to council. Council will have the ultimate decision in terms of both the scope of work and who the ultimate selection of the consultant will be, and then the process will get started from there. Once the city has identified who the consultant will be, then PGE will deliver the confidential tax documents to that consultant, and the review of those records will begin, and a report will be written up and submitted to the council sometime in the next 6 months after that. So that's the timeline we're looking at. Again, Mayor Potter, I think before you had concerns, or I've understand that you had concerns about how the process was going to work in terms of when the consultant would be selected and what the ultimate cost would be, and those are decisions that will come back before the council, and the council will be making that decision in a separate public vote.
Thank you.
And I'm here to answer any other questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a testimony sheet?
I did not have one set out.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify to this matter? Please call the vote.
Adams?
Thank you for your work on this, Commissioner Stinn and staff. Seems like a very prudent and reasonable settlement. Aye.
Leonard?
I, too, appreciate all of the hard work that's gone into this. I arrived on the council just about 5 years ago, and from that time till now, this has been an ongoing issue in one format or another. In my view, the utilities that provide Portlanders with electricity or natural gas are not traditional businesses in the sense that they're subject to the standard supply and demand forces of an open economy. They are regulated monopolies. They compete with no one. They raise their rates when they can convince the PUC to raise their rates. And oftentimes, some of the evidence that's used to justify a rate increase, in my view, that is then approved is unfair to the consumers. That gets to the heart of why I think it's important for us to keep pursuing the path that we are, and that is to make sure that in the case of at least this one utility, Portland General Electric, they're playing fairly with consumers. That when you get a bill, you reasonably expect that that bill reflects what you should be paying and doesn't have built into it charges and profits that are unfair. So to that end, I greatly appreciate the work of Commissioner Stinn in heading these negotiations, and particularly the work of Ben Walters and Tracy Reeves as well, because this truly is the kind of work that government is expected to do on behalf of its citizens. And I think you've all done an outstanding job, and I'm pleased to support this. Aye.
Stinn.
Well, I appreciated this. We really don't know what will come of these documents, but I think that in the long run, it will serve everyone's interest. And although they would not agree with me, I certainly think a locally owned Portland General Electric, which is what we do have again, and I think is a good step forward from being owned by Enron, is, I think, in the long run better served if they cannot be bought for the sole purpose of making money off taxes, which it actually has been part of the strategy that multinationals have used in acquiring local utilities, is to say if we go in there and buy it, we can actually combine this company with another company we have that's losing money and keep the taxes that are built into the rates. And so I don't think it's any surprise to anyone in the room. I still think a publicly owned utility would make a lot more sense. And as you pay your bills, remember there is another option. But as long as we've got a private utility here, we want to make sure that it has the best chance that it can to be the next best thing, which I think it is right now, which is locally owned, locally run, and what you pay for is what you get. And obviously that's not what happened under Enron. So we'll take these documents, see if we can't come up with, bring some more light onto what actually happened with, I think at this point, the discrete and sole purpose of trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. Aye.
Potter.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Stan, for your leadership on this. And all the folks from the city attorney's office that worked on this. I think that this information will provide us and shed some light on a dark period of history for the United States and certainly for Portland with the whole Enron mess. And I would hope that that from those we can learn some lessons and also bring to light if there are issues to be resolved either legally or otherwise. So thank you, Commissioner Stinn. I vote aye. Please read the 245 times certain.
Item 1287, amend contract with Alta Planning and Design for expansion, continued development, and implementation of the Safer Routes to School National Model Pilot Program.
All these heard together? Hmm? All these heard together, all three. Yeah. Could you read item 1288 and 1289 as well?
Mm-hmm. 1288, authorized 2007-2012 intergovernmental agreements with school districts to participate in the Portland Safer Routes to School Program. 1289, accept a $100,000 non-infrastructure grant from the Oregon Department of Transportation for Portland Safer Routes to School Program.
Commissioner Adams?
Well, we are, the nation looks to us to continue to innovate in getting more bikes and teachers and parents to walk and bike to school more often. And we are very lucky to have partners in the school district, former leaders of the city staff biking efforts who now head up a consulting firm, our own staff leadership, and others that keep us on the cutting edge of what it takes to truly offer safer routes to school. So we're going to hear about that today, and I'm pleased to introduce the panel before us.
Thank you. I'm Laura Wintergreen, the Safer Routes to Schools Project Manager with the City of Portland Office of Transportation. To my right is Mia Burke, the Principal with Alta Planning and Design. And to my left is Rob Birchfield, the City Traffic Engineer with PDOT. We appreciate this opportunity to update you on the Council and the Mayor on the Safer Routes to Schools program. It is a 5E program, and when we say that, that's inclusive of education, encouragement, enforcement, engineering, and evaluation. We wanted to do a quick start with you, an overview of the national problem, why you've been investing in safer routes to schools. There's a vicious cycle. Parents feel that streets are too dangerous. The leading cause of death for people between the ages of 4 and 34 years is traffic crashes. So there's some legitimacy to that. Parents then drive their children to school. 50% of children who are hit by cars near schools are hit by cars driven by the parents of other students. Traffic increases. 20 to 30% of morning traffic is parents driving their children to schools. Parents feel that streets are too dangerous. 75% of children between the ages of 5 and 9 are killed in collisions. When they were actually driving and riding in cars. And then fewer children walk and bicycle to school. In 1969, 42% of students walked to school. In 2001, 16% of students walked to school. Portland has its replication of the national problem. Earlier this month, three high school students were injured while using a crosswalk on North Williams. But on the other hand, you can see from the chart that the city's investment in engineering infrastructure, education, and encouragement programs has Portland seeing a positive trend as opposed to the national trend. The solution, Portland Safer Routes to Schools solution, is a coalition-led program managed by the City of Portland Office of Transportation with services provided by, including the Portland Office of Transportation. We do have transportation options. Janice McDonald is here today representing them. The Portland Police Bureau, Alta Planning and Design, represented by Mia Burke. The Bicycle Transportation Alliance and Willamette Pedestrian Coalition, represented by Angela Koch behind us. The Alliance for Traffic Safety in Oregon, the Community Cycling Center, Northwest Service Academy AmeriCorps, Multnomah County Health Department's Healthy Eating, Active Living, represented by Sonia Manjas behind me, and then Legacy Emanuel Trauma Nurses Talk Tough. A total of 6,600 students participated in the Safer Routes to Schools education program in 2006-2007. The education focuses on pedestrian safety, bicycle safety, and child passenger safety. This and further evaluation information is in the 8.5 by 11 annual report you should have received with your packet if you wanted to look at more. What we have found is that in terms of parent attitude, evaluation has shown that 94% of parents agree that walking and bicycling to school are healthy for students. When we look at what the parents identified as issues affecting their travel decisions, we find that the number one concern is distance from the school. We note that this may well be impacted by the number of students no longer attending their neighborhood schools due to the school option choices in No Child Left Behind, and then also by the school consolidation issues. Numbers 2 and 4, next ranked highest, are issues that the Safer Routes to Schools program is actively addressing. And the fifth number is an issue that generally the Safer Routes to Schools budget cannot address. It is sidewalks and pathways as a city infrastructure issue. And there is potential through the Safe Sound and Green Streets initiative that Commissioner Adams is promoting. To go on, I just want to quickly share with you some of our highlights and successes. In North Portland, in Chief Joseph Elementary School, we saw a 35% increase in walking to school since the Safer Route School program joined them. In Southeast Portland, Sunnyside Environmental, which is a magnet school, more than doubled their number of students riding their bicycles to school. Outer Northeast Sacramento Elementary School saw 62% of the students walking and biking to school on Earth Day. And then Gilbert Heights in Outer Southeast had a 53% increase in walking to school. Overall, between spring 2006 and spring 2007, schools involved with the Safer Routes to Schools program averaged a 24% increase in walking to school. We currently serve 25 schools, and if you want to find the list of the schools as opposed to this map, that will be in the brochure you have at the top of your packet. Engineering, one of the 5 E's. School coordinators form school-based Safer Routes to School teams. These teams, along with the school and neighborhood community, identify concerns and prioritize safety projects and solutions. In your packets, you each have a set of the family-friendly maps that we have from the different Safer Routes to Schools facilities. Mark Yelton designed the maps with the help of the school team. The maps are available in 6 languages, and enlarged maps are posted in the school so that students and parents can identify their preferred routes. As you can see in the picture, Scott Batson, a city traffic engineer extraordinaire, works with each school team. He attends the walkabout, produces an engineering report, a draft improvement plan, and finally, the school's Safer Routes to Schools strategy. In your packet, you'll also see a spreadsheet that shows the projects that we have provided for the first-year schools, the 2005-2006 schools. Enforcement is another E, and we have partnered with the Portland Police Bureau. They monitor the school speed zone and crossing enforcement for all schools during back-to-school week. They really do a blitz during that week to make sure that everybody understands school is started and keeping students safe. In addition, this year, they are picking a school every day, whereby they go back and reinforce those issues. They also reinforce when we put in improvements to help train and educate the community. They reinforce that by being there. They respond to school safety requests. They train safety patrol, and they support us during school events. Next, Mia Burke will talk with you about the other E's.
Thank you, Mayor Potter, Commissioners. Our team has been such a pleasure to work in these schools these last 2.5 years. Our partners with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and ACTS Oregon Community Cycling Center, Trauma Nurses Talk Tough, and Multnomah County HEAL have been working in these 25 schools on four components of our education program focused around child passenger safety, bicycle safety, pedestrian safety, and after-school pedal power squad. Staff have also been working at the school level to help make this process as smooth as possible and to help engage the community within the school and around the school to embrace bicycling walking as a part of the way that our schools do their business on a daily basis in Portland, and to integrate this into the way that parents and students see transportation choices. The staff of our program assist PDOT in developing the engineering solutions and the family-friendly bike maps, and develop a series of encouragement activities, some of which you have participated in. As you know, this year we had close to 3,000 children participating in International Bike and Walk to School Day, and we thank you for your participation in that. We have other events such as walking school buses and daily bike and walk events and other activities in the schools that are helping to encourage children and their parents to embrace bicycling and walking. We've continued to innovate in this program as well so that we can provide more for less to keep expanding the services citywide. We have been adding more schools, specifically in the last year, adding 7 schools that were coordinated with the School Family Housing Initiative that Commissioner Sten and this council had brought forth. We have been teaming with Transportation Options on developing a Smart Trips component to gauge whether focusing on the individualized marketing program for parents, coupled with the focus on children in the school, has a better result, and we're doing that with AmeriCorps as a partner through the AmeriCorps Service Program at Reiki Elementary School in Southeast Portland. Then we're also teaming with Multnomah County's HEAL program, focused on the health aspects of bicycling and walking at Clarendon at Portsmouth, and continuing to work to develop curriculum that can be integrated into classrooms, as well as looking for how schools can sustain this once we've done a focused effort to get this up and running in the individual schools. Rob Birchfield will now talk about the future of the program.
And a little bit of a history. As you know, we've grown the program from 8 schools in 2005, and we're now able to serve 25 schools. With that, we've of course needed to increase the funding available for the program. The program's been funded primarily through traffic fine revenue, traffic citation revenue, which we have dedicated to traffic safety programs. And we've also had one-time general fund dollars available that we've been able to dedicate to this program as well, and we appreciate council's support for that. When we started in 2005-06, our cost per school was about $42,000 per school. Since that time, we've been able to decrease that cost per school by about half, and we now think we're able to provide services to schools on an ongoing basis at about a rate of $20,000 per school per year. So we've done that by streamlining the services we've provided and really focusing on what we think is most effective. The The contract structure that we're asking you to approve today it is a little bit unusual in that it has a number of service providers within the contract. The total allocation of dollars is $540,000 for the 07-08 school year or calendar year, fiscal year. 63% of that will go to the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. They provide the in-school services.